Hello and welcome to the MDS podcast, the official podcast of the International Parkinson's and Movement Disorder Society. I'm Alfonso Fasano, professor of neurology at the University of Toronto in Canada, and I'm the guest editor for this new special series on tremor. Today we have a very special topic and very special guest that I'm honored to interview. Today we have Professor Deutschel from University of Kiel and Professor Bhatia from University College of London in the UK. And here with us, these giants in the tremor research are to discuss the topic, what's essential tremor. So what's essential tremor is the title of this episode. And first of all, I want to thank the speakers for having accepted to be with us today. Thank you.
Good morning, Alfonso, and thank you for inviting us on this.
Okay, so I decided to invite you both at the same time because you've been the soul of the new classification of tremor that came up, I believe, in 2018. You're respectively the first and senior author of that publication. And I know that publication took a while to be completed and several discussions amongst the different experts. So first of all, before we get into the topic of essential tremor, I would like to ask you one question. I'll ask the same question to both of you so that you both have the time to answer. Starting from Professor Bhatia, I would like to ask you, what do you like of the new classification?
Yeah, I think what I like about the new classification mainly is that the plea for my side was that we consider essential tremor as a syndrome. And that is what has been effectively brought out in this new classification. Because the previous classification, although they were good, a lot of people used to think about essential tremor as one discrete entity. And they would think about essential tremor as a disease, as one disease or one disorder. And I think the main input we have given with this is to highlight or bring out the fact that essential tremor is a syndrome and not one disease.
Okay, thank you. And same question to Professor Deutschel, who was also the first author of the first classification of tremor that came up years ago, 1996, if I'm not mistaken. What do you like about the new classification?
Similar as Professor Bhatia, I think it has opened a little bit the description of what essential tremor is. I think every neurologist knows that it is a complicated definition. It is very simple in terms of what the inclusion criteria are, but in essence, whether we really capture always the same kind of disease with this is very much in question. And what we did is really to ask people to describe what they see, what they think, what under this diagnosis is meant to be essential tremor. And I think that's the progress of this part of the classification.
Thank you. Now, a question for you directly, because I want to alternate between the answers, pretty much like the presidential debate. And the question is, what don't you like about the new classification?
That people misunderstand it, and they interpret it in their way, saying that a description is itself a diagnosis, which has never been intended like this. It clearly says describe what you see, and what we have defined this term essential tremor plus, just to encourage people to really describe what they see. It is one of the most important problems of the past 20 years that people simply say it's all essential tremor and they don't describe what they see. There are subtle symptoms that separate one patient from the other. And a misunderstanding of that means that they don't understand the core of the definition.
Thank you. Same question to you, Professor Bhatia.
I totally agree with Gunther. I completely agree. I think one of the issues which there has been a lot of criticism also by you and others about this essential tremor plus idea. And I think the reason for that, as Gunther points out, people are not understanding, perhaps maybe it's a fault on our side or not, but I think the idea, the concept here, using axis one and axis two, because clinically what you perceive is on axis one. And then to make people understand that on axis one, you describe the syndrome, what you're seeing. And if it is pure, as essential tremor syndrome should be, or is it combined with other features, but maybe not strong enough features to say that it is definitely dystonic tremor or cerebellar tremor. This is what happens in life. That in pragmatically, what we are seeing in our people is what you can describe. You cannot evoke or think about the future as to what this particular patient might be in the future. You have to describe what at the moment. And I feel that this classification, as Gunther has mentioned, giving you this possibility of being able to describe and put in as many patients as you can in these two categories, which will cover a lot of our patients, which we see, is really the strength of this, rather than what you may say is a bad side of it. But I do agree with Gunther that people, particularly people who are maybe not in the field, it may be difficult for them to get the concept. But if they can understand it, then I think it's really a good classification from a pragmatic point of view, from a day-to-day use point of view, because that's what you would do as a clinician. You have to describe what you see, and this classification helps you do that.
Very good. Thank you. Now let's talk about a very practical situation. So let's imagine you are in your clinic, and there is this gentleman that comes to see you for the first time. We can call him Mr. Smith. And Mr. Smith has a little action tremor, mainly during kinetic maneuvers, a little bit on posture, nothing else. No rest tremor, of course, just an action tremor. He described what type of tremor. It's been there for about 4 or 5 years. He's 6 years old, and this tremor affects symmetrically both hands. There are not many other signs, including the famous soft signs. Maybe there's a little posturing when he's holding a posture, but you wonder whether this is just because he's learned to do that to reduce the amplitude of the tremors, more of as a compensatory maneuver. So that's the clinical picture. So let's start with Professor Badia. So this man, Mr. Smith, asks you, okay, doctor, what do I have? What's my diagnosis? What would you tell this patient?
So again, we are talking about pragmatically, practically. Okay. So for me, the main component is that, as you said, bilateral, largely symmetrical, postural kinetic tremor, he would fall into the essential tremor syndrome category. Okay. Now, I have noted the mild, as you said, a mild posture abnormality. If I was thinking about doing some research studies in him, I would put him in the essential tremor plus category, if I'm sure that this abnormal posture. I don't think we need to get into the issue about, is he doing that because of compensation? How do you know? You don't know that. You have to go by what you see. If you've seen that there is an abnormal posture, but maybe not enough to say this is definitely dystonia, he goes into the essential tremor plus for me from my research point of view. But for him, I would say you fall into this family of what we call essential tremor syndrome. That's it. As simple as that.
Yeah, I wasn't expecting for a complex answer, also because this is supposed to be the answer to give to a lay person, like a patient. So, Professor Deutscher, same question to you, same clinical scenario. What would you say?
The same. Simply. Perfect. I mean, there's not much to add. I would do some laboratory tests. I would look for thyroid function. I would ask him exactly when it started, if there was anything in the beginning. If he's suffering from any other disease, I would ask for his age and a number of things. But essentially, this is exactly what I would do, what Kailash has just mentioned.
Okay. So let's stay with you. After a day, you get a phone call from the son of this patient, who happens to be an academic gastroenterologist working in your same institution, very active in research, of course, a physician, not a neurologist, but still very interested in research, and tells you, I know you met my dad yesterday, he told me that you said it's essential tremor. We feel relieved about that. Thank you for seeing him. But can you tell me, what do you think is going on? What is this?
I would involve him into the discussion on essential tremor and age-related tremor or tremor of the aging persons, because it's very common if his dad is changing from 60 to 70 that the likelihood to develop tremor is increasing. And we don't know exactly whether this is the same as the tremor that you can see in childhood or during early years at midlife. That is still an open question. And I would tell him this is a syndrome, and perhaps the nervous system has many ways to answer to noxious conditions of all kinds, including aging processes. And one of them is to develop a tremor. And we don't know about the details here, and we will simply have to go ahead with where we are.
Yeah, so I think what I would say if to a person who's a, as you said, a researcher or a scientist himself, I would try and explain to him that essential tremor is a syndrome and that it's a moving target. So we can only go by what we see now. We would say, like Gunther said, we've excluded other things like drugs or any other causes of what might be causing his tremor, thyroid function, et cetera, and then we come to this concept about the tremors which happen in people with age, et cetera. We don't know. We call it idiopathic. We don't know the cause at the moment. And that's why it's called an idiopathic entity. But on axis two, there may be certain causes. And as time goes on, now let's see that little posturing which we have developed, which we have noticed, is developed further. He's become a dystonic tremor. Maybe there's a family history which comes out. And at that time, we might consider doing some genetic tests on him to explain to him. So that's only to a research-oriented person. If the person was, as you said, ordinary, in a derogatory manner, but I'm saying from my practical point of view, I would say you have a condition which is a very common condition, and this causes tremor, and essentially this is the sort of tremor it causes. We don't know the cause of this. There are many causes. Some of them we have already identified and removed, and in your condition, we either call it primary or idiopathic. That's it.
Perfect. So thank you for the answer. And I can see there you're pretty much aligned here on, even on this one. But then continuing with the phone call, and this is for you, Professor Bhatia. The son says, oh, thank you. This explains a lot. And I appreciate that there's heterogeneity and we don't really understand what's going to happen in the future. It's hard to predict. But I don't know if he told you, because this is something that he's not aware of. My mom is telling me that at night, and it's been about 6-7 years, when he sleeps and he dreams, he moves and he screams and he acts up his dream. Is this going to change anything? Do you need this information?
Well, again, we have to say what we see, what we go by. Because this person is, into inverted commas, educated in certain ways, I would say to him that we know that this could be what we call REM sleep behavior disorder, and that has been associated with people with Parkinson's disease. It doesn't matter whether they had essential tremor or they didn't have essential tremor. This is true for people in general. So if you're describing what we think is RBD, there is a possibility that in the future, these people have a higher risk of turning into Parkinson's disease. Now, whether this tremor which he has now is connected to that or not, I cannot say. That is not going to change my diagnosis to tell him that this tremor which I'm observing in you, which I've called essential tremor, is actually a Parkinsonian tremor. It could be, but I cannot say that for sure. This idea about the RBD is true for Parkinson's disease, not for tremor, the risk factor.
Professor Doshan, anything to add?
If it has happened once, I wouldn't care. If it's happening since 8 years, that he has these episodes frequently, once a month or twice a month, then I would really consider that. It has no consequences at the moment. We will observe this patient and check whether the RBD needs special treatment, whether it needs to be treated with the appropriate medication for that condition, but not for tremor. That will not help tremor. If it is really, which can of course happen, if it's really early Parkinson's disease, one of the first symptoms, I think it's very important that during the initial phase of Parkinson's disease, it is not uncommon that they have tremors which very much resemble essential tremor. There are people who say this is because essential tremor is the first sign of Parkinson's disease. But this is not true. This is a Parkinsonian tremor, a very early Parkinsonian tremor, and should not be mixed up with what we call essential tremor. But that depends on the severity. If it's only tremor, I would say come back in 3 months and we have a look at it. And Otherwise, if there's a research perspective, then I would certainly do a DUT scan.
I think I would like to add, I completely agree with Gunther, because at the moment, we do not have disease-modifying conditions. Okay, so there are two issues here, which are linked, but they are not completely linked. One issue is, if he doesn't have bradykinesia, and all he has is a, into inverted commas, an essential tremor syndrome, am I going to say you got Parkinson's disease? No, not at this time, okay? But if I had a disease-modifying agent, and the same scenario was to happen to, like you just mentioned, then I would certainly say, listen, if he has REM sleep behavior disorder, this is a person I might want to consider doing a DAT scan, okay? And then consider giving him the disease-modifying therapy, having discussed this. But at this time and moment, when it doesn't have a clinical implication for me to treat, am I going to treat his tremor with a levodopa? No. So I'm going to say to him, this looks like essential tremor. There are people who have RBD that who in the future may go on to develop Parkinson's. At this time, I don't see any signs of Parkinson's in your father. I only see the essential tremor syndrome. And whether he will go on to develop this or not, we would keep him under watch, as Professor Deutschel said. That would be the track. And again, there are so many implications here. If you are going to start calling people with essential tremor and who have RBD into Parkinson's disease at this point, there are insurance-based, there is so many different factors. You can't do that. He may not develop into Parkinson's.
Thanks for the detailed answer. I need just a very quick answer at this point from you, because I share the same opinions that you have. And I would say most of our listeners will share the same. But then if I want to ask, and I know that's not that scientific to us, your gut feeling with respect to this particular person, regardless of what you're going to tell the son or the patient, do you think that this is the beginning of Parkinson's? So then, in other words, this tremor is related to Parkinson's? Yes, no, maybe. What would be your answer?
Maybe.
Same. Maybe for Professor Deutschel as well?
Of course.
Okay, understood. The reason I went there is because I also wanted to pick your brain about something that always puzzled me, because we all have seen people with Parkinson's that manifest a little bit of action tremor before you can actually diagnose Parkinson's on them. And in some cases, that scan is positive. And probably these are people also with a sitting assay that would be positive. But it's always puzzling, back to my question, that the criteria for prodromal Parkinson's disease specifically excludes action tremor. So they take into account anything, including instrumental tools, but not tremor. And I would like to know what's your feeling about that. Is it okay to exclude it? Is it because it's too complicated? It should be included. So let's start with Professor Badi, I believe.
Well, again, I think here that there are two things I would say. This issue will change once we have the RT-QuIC sinuclein assay set up properly. So there, I might add that to my repertoire. So if I have somebody with an action tremor in this context of what you were talking about, RPD, etc., and particularly if there was a disease-modifying treatment, I don't think it's here is a question about what are you going to classify these people as. The question is about what can you do about it if there is a possibility of doing something. We all know that some of these action tremors might be. In the Lancet Neurology paper by Annette Schrag about prodromal, this, if you see, people had a tremor, although it was not clear which sort of tremor, 10 years before. That was one of the first things which had happened. But because it was a GP-based survey, it wasn't clear what tremor they had. But that was one of the first things they had. A tremor had been found in a large number of them, even 10 years before. So we all know it can happen. But the point here is not that. The point here is, if you will develop the RT-QuIC for the sinuclein assay properly with this for the DAT scan, this might be something you may want to keep in mind when you're seeing these patients at that particular age group, because if there is a disease-modifying treatment, you don't want to miss them. But if there isn't a disease-modifying treatment available, and all he's presenting with an action tremor, you're not going to start him on levodopa, are you? So at that time, I would say, yeah, you have an action tremor. That's it. But if there was a disease-modifying therapy, and if you were able to pick these people up with the sinuclein assay and a DAT scan, maybe combined, then of course, that is definitely people you want to pick up.
It's really interesting. I wanted to quote the same finding, Kailash. The Schrock paper is always, for me, the reference paper when it comes to prodromal symptoms of Parkinson's disease. And what I would like to add is, there's one situation where I would consider a DUT scan, even with symptoms that are so weak as we are discussing it at the moment, just a pure postural tremor. And that is when it's unilateral. Because yeah, that happens. I've seen that several times. Usually it's not long until full Parkinson's disease develops then. And we don't have disease-modifying drugs so far. But starting very early is probably, after the LEAP study, is really something that we should seriously consider. The LEAP study has now shown that even the early starters have less dyskinesia on the long run. So that may be an advantage. And after discussing that with the patient, I would consider trying then to give him, for example, MAO inhibitors or something else to look after this very first symptom of his disease or her disease.
Interesting.
Yeah, I will argue though that unilateral per se won't fulfill the criteria for essential tremor. From the very beginning, we'll be talking about a different clinical entity altogether. But I didn't get
predominant on one.
Okay, but back to the question of prodromal PD. I just need a yes/no answer. Would you add it to the criteria for prodromal PD? Because at the moment, it's not included.
I mean, the criteria are very well validated, and I would not change that. But for patient care, I would certainly add my impression of the trauma to what I think about this particular patient.
I would say that if we do get, again, a disease-modifying agent, at that time, I might consider changing the criteria to include tremor.
Then we will do it all together within the society.
Of course.
And under structured conditions.
Okay.
But I don't make private prodromal criteria.
Okay. Okay. So now this has been great so far. And unfortunately, we have very few minutes left. So just for a few final comments or questions I have for you. So the first one is very simple. Again, yes, no. Would you keep the term essential tremor for the years to come? So we'll start with Professor Doshan.
Yes.
Professor Badia?
Well, I would say it will die its own death, like happened with essential myoclonus. The term has disappeared once the gene epsilon sarcoglycan was found. So I think I would agree with Gunther that at the moment, perhaps it's useful to keep it both for patients and for lay societies, et cetera, to get funding, et cetera, and so on. But in the future, when it's more clear, it's more genetically defined, it'll be clear who are turning into Parkinson's, et cetera, it will have its own demise.
There is no hope for the next 10 years to find a gene that explains reasonably.
Yeah. Otherwise, but I'm saying the future is very long. Yeah. Maybe not in our future, but
if we have etiology, everything changes.
Yeah. And so staying with Professor Biden, that's my last question. Let's say we get rid of the term essential tremor. What term would you like to use?
Well, it depends on what you find, right? So whatever might be the underlying etiology that we call that.
Right? Okay, so you don't have a term in mind.
No, I don't think it's useful for me to venture into a new term just to replace a term which I think is already outdated in a sense.
Professor Doshan, anything to add?
I'm always puzzling with the fact that it's so age-dependent, this syndrome. And I mean, Critchley has in the past always mentioned senile tremor. And I wonder if in 10 years from now, we come back in one or the other form to this basic idea that it's something that has to do with age.
Thank you both. This has been a fantastic interview for me. Really honored that I had the chance to ask the question that I would have asked the experts. So thanks for listening. Thanks for tuning in. I want to thank again Professor Doshan from Kiel in Germany, Professor Badia from UCL in London, UK, for having joined us today in this podcast on tremor. Title of today's episode was What's Essential Tremor? And I think that for many listeners now, the picture of this complex heterogeneity that we call essential tremor has become much clearer. And I certainly agree with you that the classification has a lot of merits. And the problem is that a lot of people didn't even read it carefully. They just jumped to the conclusions that it was too confusing and they start criticizing it. But I agree with you both that there are a lot of pros in these classifications. Again, thank you.
Thank you very much for sharing it so well. And thanks to Gunther.
Thank you. Thank you, Alfonso and Kailash. Great to speak to you.
The views and opinions expressed by the participants in this podcast do not necessarily reflect those of the International Parkinson and Movement Disorder Society or their affiliated journals, Movement Disorders, and Movement Disorders Clinical Practice. Any disclosures of the participants can be found within the episode description located on the MDS website.
Thank you.